This talk was given by Charles Baslinton on the 20th of February 2012 to the Alsford Probus Club, England. The title is Researches into Free Lunches. It is about land as a resource to society and about property, that is, real estate. It's also about the resource of credit creation. The talk explores what economists usually call economic rent. It's about 30 minutes long, and there's a summary of questions at the end. Thank you very much. Thank you, Ian. Thank you for those kind words. I've handed out some sheets on the table there, which I'll refer to one of the two things in the talk, and there are links and reminders of things on that. I've also bought my book here, The Free Lunch, which... by kind permission of the chairman, I can recoup some of my lunch fee. I had to pay for a lunch. I hasten to add.
Quite right, too.
I should add this experience to my researches on free lunches. I don't want you to be under any illusions about me. I need to say that although I'm not an economist, I will be daring to speak on economic matters. So that sorts that out. So to free lunches. One use of the term free lunch is within the saying, as you all know, there is no such thing as a free lunch. Way back in the USA, some bars would offer a free lunch. Then they would make the food so salty that you had to drink a lot. Not free, to slake your thirst. Those free lunches were technically free, but with strings attached, leading straight to your wallet. I've been researching free lunches for about 15 or 20 years. This is serious business. But it is work in progress, hence the title Researching Free Lunches. Only last week I came across yet another free lunch that is giving bother. More on that in a minute. If something is said often enough, there's a danger that our senses become dulled and we may believe it. I want to expose the inaccuracy of the phrase, there is no such thing as a free lunch. I want to go beyond the narrow view of free bar meals. Those sorts are covered by the phrase, buyer beware. That is, take due diligence. If a deal seems too good to be true, it probably is. So, on the broadest view, what is the evidence of our eyes? This planet Earth provides resources and sustains life for myriads of species. Most of that life, other than us humans, gets by quite adequately with their ordinary skills through picking up whatever they need with no more effort needed than just taking it. If you were able to ask an animal or plant about free lunches, ask Prince Charles about how to do that, I'm sure. If you were able, they would wonder what the question meant. Their lives seem to consist of nothing but free lunches. But what about us humans? I started puzzling some years ago about the mismatch between the richness of the earth and its resources and the unevenness of the distribution of those resources among citizens. I first came across this error in the no free lunches idea in a book by James Robertson, where he quotes Professor Mason Gaffney talking about the banking system. The book is called Creating New Money. So I made use of the term free lunch to include the earth's natural resources when I wrote my book in 2002. This was launched by George Hollingbury, now MP. If you look in today's Times, page 5 and 6, I think it is, there's quite a bit about George Hollingbury. He's obviously making a bit of a mark up in Westminster, stirring the coalition government, I think. So I call naturally occurring resources of the earth as the primary free lunches, and the artificially created resources secondary free lunches. So to the primary and the natural. The Earth's natural resources are the basic free lunch, the source of life and the support for life, such as land itself provides food and shelter and makes transport viable. Minerals, oil, gas, gold, silver, etc., organic and inorganic things. Radio waves are another free lunch resource. There is no end to the uses of the radio spectrum, as mobile phones have shown us. Air is a free lunch, as is sunlight, as are the oceans. The main secondary free lunch, I want to talk about later, is formed within and from society itself. It happens due to the working of human relationships. It is about economics and financial matters, and it's credit, and particularly credit creation. It's what banks do, create credit. Another secondary free lunch I found recently, as I referred to, is fishing quotas, issued by the EU to bring fairness for fishermen and to preserve fish stocks. They are now causing problems for many traditional fishermen. So back to the primary free lunches and some definitions about them. These are all naturally occurring resources. The Earth is bung full of them. The planet is a supersized free lunch factory warehouse. I personally believe, from a Christian point of view, that these are all God-given and that God wants us to enjoy the resources and to try and share them fairly, at the same time being mindful of future generations' needs. Most religions of the world have at their core this sort of fairness. These naturally occurring free lunches are reshaped as society develops into personally accessible free lunches, shaped by time and place, which affects their value. Now, what makes natural free lunches so important? They are essential to ordinary life, e.g. land, oil, gas. They are in high demand, therefore. This may bring scarcity. They become valuable, but they inevitably get captured. They get owned by someone, some organization. Unfairness creeps in. Many do not own them. Now, just because a thing is in high demand and gains a high monetary value, does that mean it is a free lunch, according to my definition? Rembrandt paintings are in high demand, very desirable, very pricey, nice to have one, or even two. But one gauge of the free lunches I'm talking about is how essential are they to ordinary life? Should a gauge of living a healthy life in reasonable comfort include having at least one Rembrandt? Basically, free lunches are A, essential to survival of ordinary life, B, in high demand, and C, their scarcity brings high value. Rembrandts don't count. Although they are C, scarce, and of high value because of B, high demand, A, they are not essential to ordinary survival. So they're out. So to land as the main free lunch on the planet. Land is obviously a fundamental resource. It brings virtually everything we need for life, for survival. Now, for fairness sake, should not everyone have some sort of stake in it? A stake in nature's original free lunch? If it was possible for everyone to have an equal-sized plot of land with equally convenient facilities nearby, then fairness would be satisfied by that arrangement. But this is clearly impossible because of geography. How boring the Earth would be if this was so. Life is not like that and cannot be, especially in our high-tech society. Is there any other way? Another way to more fairly share what is a free gift to us all? Land is needed by all of us. It is essential. Land with planning permission for development is especially valuable because everyone needs somewhere to live and to work. The more desirable the location of land for our home, or the more profitable the work that can be done from land in a particular location, the higher the demand and the greater the value of the land with its planning permission. But how does this value arise? For what reason is land in central Winchester more valuable than land in Oliver's Battery? Or central Alsford land compared with land in Popley, Basingstoke? How does a demand arise that brings the value? It arises due to the many convenient facilities around. And who makes these facilities work? Who makes them possible? The people living or working around the location of the land create the value. I'll open that up. For example, the location may be desirable because there is a good school nearby. It may have good roads or a nearby railway station. It may be healthy and pleasant because there's a park nearby. And because the neighbourhood is quiet and orderly, low crime, the location may give easy access to entertainment or sport, and convenient for offices, and near a good business district. On a national level, land prices are affected by the growth of the economy. which is an effect of everyone working well together, all of us. All these things give value to the location of each separate plot of land. However, it is the people who run these facilities, the teachers at the successful schools, who raise the value of the land in the school catchment, the workers who provide the local public services, who cause the increase in the value of the land. It is not the owner of the plot of land that a house stands on that creates the value of that land. The owner may add a little, a very small part, as being part of the whole community, but the whole community's activity, for better or worse, creates the value of the land. What the owner of a property does when building or extending a house is adding to only part of the value of the whole package, the whole house plus land package. About one quarter to one third of the so-called house price is the fluctuating value of the land that attracts the attention in the media. The value of the house itself, the bricks and mortar, the actual building, will always be dropping in real terms because buildings deteriorate and need repair. We hear such news as house prices rose last month. Well, actually, more correctly, it should be land prices rose last month, or land prices fell last month, not house prices. But anyway, is it good news or bad news? House prices went up, land prices went up last month. This is mixed news. For some people, it is thoroughly bad news because they are less able to buy a home now. Just to put building and land prices in another focus, take a family home, bought some years ago and lived in for some time. How have the values changed? The current value comprises the community-inspired value of the land that you had to pay when you bought it, what you started off with. Two, the community-inspired value of the land that has come to you during those years since you bought it. And three, the value of the bricks and mortar that you bought it at, less depreciation, plus what you needed to spend to maintain it or extend it. I suggest that it is fair to say that if you provide something, it is yours. If you provide your labour, if you work, you should keep the income earned. If you spend money on a building, if you are creative, you should have full claim to what you made. You get something for something, quid pro quo, this for that, a fair deal. Fairness means that you take your reward for your effort. Unfairness happens when you do something and someone else gets the reward. So if the community creates the value of land, so the community should use part of that value, say through a tax or a levy, to pay for those things that give the land its value. A levy to pay for the schools, the roads, the public services, which are the triggers for the attractiveness. The freeholder keeps the title to the property. This is not communism. They just have to pay for the proportionate benefit that they enjoy from land at that location. Fair's fair. But what happens now instead? We are charged tax on our work, income tax. This is a disincentive to work. We are charged tax on things that people make, value-added tax, VAT. This is a disincentive to buy things and provide employment. We are charged tax on repairing our buildings, which is a disincentive to keeping accommodation in good nick. We pay council tax on the size of our buildings, which is a disincentive to improving them. A levy on land values would give an incentive to develop underused, valuable land. But there is no levy or tax on homeowners for their land use, which actually brings them monetary gain. Households will experience a real monetary gain if they've been homeowners for their working lives. It would be very unusual not to gain, even in real terms. If you get the timing right, gains can be really good. Do you know about the 17-year property price cycle from peak to peak? I have something about it in my book. I wrote in 2002 on this. It pointed to the house price peak expected in 2007, 5 years later, counting from 1990, the last peak, add 17 years, and the peak happened in 2007, as we know. The free lunch in land values goes to freeholders only, not to renters. The freeholders pay the taxes, which pay for the schools, public facilities, etc. But eventually, if they downsize their home, they will receive the raised land value as a kind of tax clawback. Or their heirs will, if they don't sell up themselves. But people who rent their homes also pay the same taxes for the schools, etc., etc. But they get no such clawback in raised land values. How fair is this? Taxes should be cut, in my view, on income and on goods and services, and put on land value. This is would be fairer all round, and it is indeed recognised as efficient in terms of economic theory, which I won't go into, but that is true. Some land gain is actually taken for new development gains, which flow from the grant of planning permission. These are called Section 106 agreements. They're probably coming to an end at the moment. That's something I read today on the internet. It's my job as a parish clerk. The developer is made to pay for improvements in the local area, so some of the private gain is diverted to the public good. The new London Crossrail railway is being paid for partly in this way, and also through an extra business rate. There's a new thing coming in called community infrastructure, something or others, levy, which will take over Section 106 agreements, apparently. However, established residential property everywhere enjoys gains in more years than not, and we homeowners get off scot-free. That bothers me. Is it fair? No wonder we have to pay such high welfare to the poorest, who mostly are renters. Here is one specific example of how spending taxpayers' money finds its way back into the pockets of freeholders through land value gains around their towns. It's dated June 2011, last year, and shows that the average gain in house prices in the town or village bypass was 15%, 15%. That was in 24 locations studied, and the range of value uplift was 9% to 30%. Now on to secondary free lunches. To the artificially created free lunches, those created by society. We're moving on to banking, what it is and how it works. The community itself provides the circumstances for the amazing artificial resource of credit to be created. Society needs credit. Most of us, whether for a business or personally, at some time need the ready money provided by credit, so that a business can quickly get busy to bring useful goods and services to market, employ people, increase wealth. We don't have to wait until we've collected or saved up all the capital before we start, get the credit, and we're in business. Now, where does this credit come from? Do banks just pass on the savings of the savers and make loans? Does the government or the state-owned central bank, the Bank of England, create this credit for business to use? The notes and coins we use are indeed produced by the Bank of England. This is about 2% or 3% of the money needs of the economy. The remaining 97% of money is created by the commercial banks. And they're created out of nothing, and the interest is the profit. They create it out of minimal reserves. It is called fractional reserve banking. Modern banking is not to do with waiting for a deposit from person A before lending that deposit to person B. If someone wants a loan and the borrower is financially sound, then the loan will be provided out of thin air by the bank. The profit from that credit is the interest charged over the length of the loan, and a new free lunch has been cooked up and taken by the banks, the interest. Now, bankers are nice people. We have some ex-bankers here. They are nice people. The problem is not bankers, but the way the banking system has grown up over the centuries without proper democratic discussion. This is quite serious. It's grown this way. I have a short interview on YouTube with an economics professor, Richard Werner, of the University of Southampton. He is the guy who invented the term quantitative easing, which we all get so fed up with hearing. invented it to mean something other than what they actually use it to mean. But I have, if you look at the links on YouTube, he's done a short series, and one of them is on banking and the economy. It's 6 minutes long. It's an eye-opener. I needed him to explain how the simple way that banking would works, and he did it very succinctly, and anybody can understand it. 6 minutes. Okay, the bank created a loan, and it will be spent and used and end up being deposited in a bank somewhere, and maybe someone will be getting a little bit of interest somewhere in the banking system from that same money. But the net interest to banks from the loans is a huge growing serving of free lunches for them. This is called credit creation. It is not much mentioned in the media, but since it is a fundamental aspect of our economic system, it needs to be talked about much more. All this, of course, makes it clear why banks are able to be paid such large salaries, as well as such large half bonuses that politicians get them to reduce to sometimes. A useful aid to the detection of free lunches is to spot enormous salaries and see if you can trace these back to source in a free lunch. Did the income rise from an entrepreneur working hard and carving out new areas of productive business? Or did it come from a monopolistic source such as credit creation? Free lunches of the type I define invariably arise from the private use of such monopoly power. I put it to you that the community itself, especially a successful society, provides the peaceful backdrop to credit creation that is the basic work of banks. What makes a successful society? Rights are respected, law is upheld, children are in school, students are in university, work is done, rubbish is collected, credit is safely created, borrowed, used and repaid. If you were in a war zone where society had broken down somewhat and few things worked, you would have great difficulty borrowing money. Credit would not flow. Normal life ceases. Life becomes intolerable. But normally it is all of us who create the essential conditions for businesses to bring forward improvements for human progress, for which we need credit. So, we find ourselves with the privately commercial banking monopoly in the same situation as with land. The normal, everyday working of everyone in the community enables credit to be created out of nothing. But it is not us, the community, that takes the benefit from it. It is privately owned banks. To repeat, fairness means you take a reward due from your effort. You get something for something, quid pro quo. What originates from the community should return to the community, but it is banks that have taken the biscuit. In this case, an enormous biscuit barrel of free lunches. It is ironic in these troubled economic times that the banking system, using the monopoly of credit creation, has actually created an economic and financial disaster that makes it look as though we are in a war zone, especially in mainland Europe. Maybe some of the top people did not appreciate the subtleties of wise banking, such as take it steady, don't kill the golden goose, but at least the problem is exposed. But will it make any difference? Or will the same old gravy train trundle along in years to come? Maybe there is a better way of arranging this? I believe the banking toy of credit creation is far too dangerous to be left in commercial private hands anymore. It needs to come under democratic control. So what can be done? The government, the Treasury, along with the central bank, could create the credit needed, then lend it wholesale to licensed banks, who would then retail it out to those who want credit. The profit interest that is currently made by banks from their monopoly of credit creation would flow to the government as they took democratic control of it, and this transfer of profits from banks to government would mean cuts in our taxes. I ask, could this arrangement make a bigger mess of it than the banks have made up to now? Another way the governments could create credit is to create it debt-free and interest-free for investment in public works. The banks now have this monopoly of creating credit, and they use it to create the indebtedness of governments. And thus we taxpayers are indebted, and our children and our grandchildren. But for much public spending on infrastructure, there is no need for governments to borrow from banks. They could create the money without debt and without interest, and invest in infrastructure works to release productive general economic activity without inflation, no debt, no interest, reduce the tax burden for the future. Unfortunately, these things are not discussed much in the media, although on the internet we do see many more people are starting to campaign for them. I have another interview video where Richard Werner talks about debt-free and interest-free money. Very short. One final free lunch for all. In Alaska, everyone is given a regular income provided by some of that state's oil supply sales. It is unconditional. It is not means-tested. Look it up on the internet. Alaska Permanent Fund. Alaska Permanent Fund. Some of the royalties from oil production go to the government, but some is reserved for citizens directly. A payment is made to every Alaskan citizen. Adults and children are each receiving about $1,200 for the dividend year of 2011 just declared, about the same as the previous year. So a family of four people this year will get about $5,000 handout, $95 a week, which is about £60 sterling per week. This is a long-standing, proven demonstration of what I'm talking about. In Alaska, this free lunch from oil wealth, nature's resources, is shared directly by all citizens. Monopoly. Did you know that the game of Monopoly was originally invented to explain how wealth accumulates in land value? It followed the studies of a man called Henry George. The game is now somewhat different to the original, but one aspect does remain. Receive salary £200 as you pass go. This followed Henry George's idea that everyone should receive a citizen's income. In the UK, we did not go the Alaskan way with North Sea oil. The huge North Sea oil revenues, which, like mineral wealth, generally have been taken in the UK as commonwealth for the state for public spending for many years, but they just continued to go into general receipts for the government. But free lunch wealth from oil wealth, from land value, from credit creation could be shared in the way of a citizen's dividend, or as I call it in my book, a citizen's royalty. It might radically address welfare problems. Love your neighbour as yourself is a basic rule for society. Most religions have come up with this sort of idea in some form. But how closely in our society do we follow this, as we allow certain sections of the community to capture commonwealth? Our society is somewhat unfairly divided, particularly between freeholders and renters, which is not good in my view. And I say that as a freeholder myself. Politicians have spoken of citizen empowerment, but I think it needs the diversion of the wealth of common resources to all citizens to make much difference. I suggest that the spreading around of free lunches from natural and community resources is the place to start, to bring a permanent shift in fairness and citizen empowerment at the same time. Thank you. Comments and questions followed. Someone wondered why the government, through its quantitative easing measures, shouldn't direct money towards public works rather than just to banks. There wasn't any conclusion about this, but it was noted that there was an absence of much discussion in the media about it, and it was wondered whether people lent on the media not to discuss certain things. Someone asked about agricultural land, which is the largest category of land use in the UK. A tax on land would not be a land tax as such, but a land value tax. It is not so much an acre, but it depends on the value of the land in that particular location. So agricultural land would not attract very much tax, being of low value, although some agricultural land would be more valuable than other agricultural land and might attract a small level of tax proportionately.
The last comment was about capitalism, which is all about the market, and how important it is to let markets work. Now, whilst markets are important, inevitable, and should be allowed to work as freely as possible, the problem is that some people never join in the game. Chapter 1 in the book deals with the unfairness of how many people are never allowed to participate. There isn't a level playing field for everyone. High welfare cost is thus paid out to redress this. The aim should be to reduce welfare by sharing out fairly some of the common wealth that everyone creates. To buy a copy of the book referred to, The Free Lunch, subtitle Fairness with Freedom, go to Amazon or to the website the-free-lunch.com. See also the blog, the-free-lunch.blogspot.com.